back to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is our first program of 2008. And I am your host, Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia. A warm welcome to regulars and new listeners wherever you might be. The website is redicecreations.com, and we are in for an exciting new year. Lots of new things are going to be launched this year, and one of them, of course, being our live shows. We're a few steps away from our first live program, but do stay tuned. Much more on that is coming. Okay, for this program here today, we are going to focus on the issue of global warming. We have Michael Kaufman with us on the line. Michael is currently president of Environmental Perspectives Incorporated and the executive director of Sovereignty International. And I recently saw his film called Global Warming or Global Governance that we're going to talk more about here today. You might also have seen him in Alex Jones' film Endgame, where he was prominently featured in the 1.5 version of that film. The websites that you can take a look at and follow along here during our program today is globalwarminggloballgovernance.com, but also do take a look at sovereignty.net and discerningtoday.org for much more on that. So let's say welcome to Michael Kaufman to the program. Nice to have you here, sir, and thank you for coming on Red Ice Creations Radio.
Well, you're more than welcome. I'm glad to be aboard.
Excellent. You know, we're going to begin here today to talk a little bit about the science, I guess, of global warming, and then later on talk more about the global governance aspect of this in our second segment. But first, Michael, I'd like to hear a little bit about your background, if you will, in regards, I guess, to your environmental studies.
Yes, I have a PhD in ecosystems analysis and have been involved in research and teaching for about 25 years when I was tapped to lead a multi-million dollar research effort on the effects of global warming on our nation's forests and ecosystems. And in the process of doing that, I became very, very concerned. Initially, I really believed that man was causing global warming because of the increase in carbon dioxide emissions. But as I got into more and more of the research just was not holding that up. And as a result, I eventually began to do research on the side as to what is going on behind the scenes to be able to drive this agenda on the global warming, the biodiversity, and a number of other issues that, you know, they have some merit and truth, and there's some link to truth, but at the same time, the scientific evidence just was not very strong in supporting what the world or the United Nations and others were claiming were actually happening. And as a consequence, what I found was that there was a huge agenda out there basically using these surrogate issues like global warming to convince citizens of the world to give up their freedoms and to ascribe to what they call global governance. And it was at that point that I left my job and begin to really do efforts in order to help people understand what is really behind a lot of these environmental scare stories.
Yeah. So, I mean, when did your kind of alarm bells, I guess, first, you know, went off, so to speak, in regards to the hype, I guess we could say, of global warming?
Yes, exactly. It was global warming that really began to make me aware that there was something more beyond just the science and the efforts to create, to protect our environment. I'm all for protecting our environment. Don't get me wrong. We do have environmental problems.
Yeah.
But at the same time, global warming is an issue that we can't do much about because the science that exists basically supports the concept that it's a natural part of a natural cycle, not man-caused.
Sure. Exactly. I mean, let's talk a little bit about that, the, I guess, reality and the science behind it. I guess the first thing I'd like to ask you is, do you think that there is some kind of, how should I put it, dramatic climate change happening right now on Earth?
No, I really don't. What is happening is really not that dramatic. If you go back in time, even the last 10,000 years since the last ice age, you will find where climate has changed, where Earth has warmed by several degrees within a matter of several hundred years. So what we're experiencing right now is not that untypical of what has happened in the past, relatively recent past, as far as geologic time is concerned.
Well, exactly. I mean, that was one of my questions here, that in regards to if we, humanity, kind of have the proper perspective on climate change, considering that we haven't, you know, studied and monitored climate change for such a long time, right?
That is correct. We have an ability to kind of piece together the history of Earth's climate through paleontologic work and other types of activities that will help us to understand what the temperatures were, what the CO2 levels were, and so forth, and through geologic time, or at least back through the several hundred thousand years. It's not perfect. Any one measurement is probably subject to error, but as a trend, I think it gives us a fairly accurate picture of what has happened in the past.
Mm. And in this, we have a few things I guess we could refer to. We've had something called the Little Ice Age, and then we have something called the Medieval Optimal. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, very much so. In fact, what we're experiencing here is nothing more, what we believe, is the response or the recovery from what is known as the Little Ice Age, which occurred back in the 1617 and early 1800s, where it was a full degree to a degree and a half colder than it is right now. That's where in Europe you had crop failures, we had plagues, they had a number of things where it was a very rough time to live during that 200 to 300 year period. And now we're recovering from that. We're going back to more optimal conditions that existed back around 1,000 years ago, starting about 800 B.C. to about 1,200 B.C. It was considerably warmer than it is right now, up to a degree warmer than it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was called the Medieval Optimal. And at that time is when you had some of the major, in Europe, some of the major expansions, the big cathedral building and so forth.
Yeah.
It was a time of a much better time because it was much warmer. Generally speaking, both man and nature does much better when it's warmer than when it's colder.
That's a very interesting aspect, and let's return to that a little bit later and talk about, you know, some of the advantages, I guess, of CO2 and so forth. But you know, there's so much information out there now, and of course, conflicting information in regards to what is true and what is not when it comes to science. We have, you know, we're shown hockey sticks and graphs of I-Corps samples, and you know, how the heck can we sort out, you know, what is true and what is not here?
Well, that's the problem, because the mainstream media, probably in Europe as well as here in the United States, has taken this as almost a cause where they're not trying to give both sides of the picture, but only one side of the picture. And what we're seeing is what I believe to be a deliberate effort on the part of some of the international community to portray a picture where man is causing global warming with this utter catastrophe awaiting for us if we do not do something immediately, like initiate the Kyoto Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And what concerns me the most about this is the average person has no way to discern unless they start digging into it. And you don't have to dig into it very far before you start finding some of the truth. But on the average, you know, when you're going about your day-to-day business, there's really no way you can determine exactly what is truth and what is false. And because the media has almost had this constant drumbeat, especially the last 10 years,
mm-hmm.
that man is causing global warming, at least here in this country, and probably is true in Europe too,
sure.
that 80% of the people believe that man is causing global warming. Now, some of them don't believe it as much as others, but at the same time, it's a given as far as most people are concerned.
Sure, yep, that's right. And it seems to be really kind of catched on because, before that, it seems like there were proponents, so to speak, of global warming around, but they weren't given, you know, that much, you know, time in the media and so forth. But then all of a sudden, you know, incredibly increasing, all the big media outlets out there were starting to focus on this. What do you think were kind of the turning point in that, you know, phase, so to speak?
Well, I think we are in a turning point, and I think it may be very much to the truth advantage. 2007 turned out to be a very significant year for peer-reviewed published research in the sense that a number of things were found that tend to discredit the man-caused global warming theory. So depending upon what happens in 2008, we may see the ability to begin to bring some of the hard facts to the people of the world, basically. It's not just the United States, it's not just Europe, but it's
sure.
the entire world is involved in this,
yep.
and helped people to understand that, you know, maybe we aren't in the crisis, and the best policy is to take, let's do some more research, let's take a hard look at this before we make any major global policy decisions.
So what you're talking about here is you're saying that we should be a little bit more conservative, I guess, in that regard, because and don't kind of rush into this, because this could this could even affect the climate in a way that we aren't aware of yet, right?
Well, that is very true, and that's one of the things that is not mentioned. I'm glad you brought that up. I don't normally think of bringing that up in a radio program, is that if we embark upon a program such as the Kyoto Protocol, which I know is not working very well even in Europe at this particular point in time because it's so draconian and has such a horrible consequence on the economies of nations that try to do it, but if that were actually implemented and we did reduce the gross domestic product of the various nations implementing it by as much as 10% or something, it would have serious economic consequences, and we would not have the ability financially to carry out what we need to do to protect the environment, and it will have downstream adverse environmental consequences, just as you're suggesting, as well as economic consequences.
Yeah, let's return also to that a little bit later and talk about the things that is going on with the laws and so forth, and potentially carbon tax going in and all that. But, you know, I would like to spend a little bit of time and kind of talking about the your film, of course, Global Warming or Global Governance. And in that film, I think you excellently point out a few of the kind of, the consensus of the science out there. One, of course, is that I mentioned before, the hockey stick graph, and one is the ice core samples. But if you will, talk a little bit about the so-called hockey stick.
Well, that's a very good point. In 2001, and actually the work was done in 1998, led by a research team led by a person by the name of Michael Mann. And in that process, they did a statistical analysis of all the temperatures over the last 1,000 years or so. And what they did is, and you've seen this on television and your newspaper and so forth, showing that we've had a relatively stable temperature over the last 1,000 years until the mid part of the 20th century, when all of a sudden it started to skyrocket. And if you look at that, it looks like a hockey stick on its back, where the actual puck part is sticking up in the air. That's why they call it the hockey stick. And that particular curve was featured in the 2001 United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report. That we just got another one in 2007. But in 2001, that particular graph was featured, and it was featured in a way to point out that it was a smoking gun to prove that man was causing global warming. And much media attention was given to it back in those days, and actually it was the proof. Finally, they had the proof that man was causing global warming. Well, it was interesting because the United Nations did not do any background check on the science involved in creating that graph. And the scientists themselves that did the graph, or did actually create it, would refuse to release the data that they used to any other scientists to verify it for a number of years. And finally, a team in Canada, led by David McIntyre and McKendrick, and two economists, basically, that are very well-versed in statistics, finally found out that the data set that they used, and were able to get that data set and then run their own analysis using the data, or using the statistical packages that were used by Michael Mann and the others. And what they found was that you could put any type of data in. You could put random data in this statistical package, and when you used it, it would come out with a hockey stick. It didn't matter what kind of data you used. And as a consequence, the hockey stick was pretty well thrashed and discredited by this team in Canada, and they were able to say, I think fairly conclusively, that the hockey stick was an invalid use of statistics and was not an accurate portrayal of exactly what the temperatures have been doing over the last 1,000 to 4,000 years. And in 2007, when the IPCC issued its fourth report, the hockey stick wasn't even mentioned. It was just like it never existed in the first place.
Really?
And this is what they do a lot with the failed attempts to prove that man is causing global warming, when they finally found out that the data was erroneous or was used incorrectly or whatever. They just ignore it. They don't try to admit that they've ever made a mistake.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. So they just omit that part and then, you know, move on to the next piece of evidence, so to speak.
Correct.
So, I mean, what about this thing with the, let's talk about the ice core samples. Again, in your film, you pointed out that the CO2 levels and in regards to the ice core samples, that and this was pretty interesting, that when you did the overlay of these two, we could see that I guess that CO2 actually drives the or the other way around, I should say, the temperature actually drives CO2 levels. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, this is, I think, one of the most classic deceptive tools that have been used by the IPCC, and Al Gore used it in his film, The Inconvenient Truth, where they can actually track CO2 levels back to 450 to 650,000 years ago through taking these ice cores. And they can also determine what the relative temperatures were during that period of time. And again, none of these are exactly accurate. You cannot possibly get this isn't an exact portrayal of exactly what happened back there, but it is a very accurate trend. I mean, it is very good from that particular perspective. And what Al Gore and the IPCC do is they split those two curves, and then we put one over the top of the other. They show that CO2 goes up during the interglacial periods and goes down during the ice ages and so forth. And then on the bottom of this, well below it, they'll show what the temperature does, and the temperature seems to follow. There is a very high degree of correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature.
Yeah.
And it's true, there's probably a very high degree of correlation, but a correlation does not make a cause and effect. You cannot use correlation as a cause and effect. I can say with a high degree of accuracy that there is 100% correlation that every person that's breathing air today is going to eventually die. It doesn't mean that breathing air causes your death. It just means that there is a high correlation.
Sure, yeah.
And that makes sense. In fact, if you don't breathe, you're going to die a lot sooner.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
The fact is, though, that they're trying to make this correlation say that CO2 is causing the temperature. When CO2 goes up, temperature goes up, and when CO2 goes down, temperature goes down. The problem is when you superimpose these graphs, and this is why they do not superimpose them. If you superimpose these graphs, you'll find that almost every time the temperature will go up before the carbon dioxide goes up, or the temperature will go down before the carbon dioxide goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And there's around an 800-year lag between the two. Now, is there a physical cause of this, where a physical cause can cause both of these things to happen? Yes. When it gets warmer, when the Earth begins to warm, the oceans begin to warm. It takes a while for that to happen, but as oceans warm, there's 40 times more carbon dioxide in oceans than there is in the air. In the oceans, carbon dioxide becomes less soluble when it's warmer. So as the oceans warm up, they release a lot of this carbon dioxide, and the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere go up.
Sure.
When the oceans begin to cool, then carbon dioxide is reabsorbed back into the oceans. And that's the reason there's a high correlation.
Interesting. So you're saying 800 years lag. That's pretty long time, though.
It is. And that's the reason why is that the oceans, the volume of the oceans and the specific heat of the oceans versus the air are so radically different. And there's been a number of studies. I'm not an oceanographer, so I can't say with accuracy exactly what happens. But at the same time, it takes a lot more heat to warm up oceans than it does the air. And there's a lag period of several hundred years, generally.
Okay, so we can say then with a certain degree, I guess, of certainty that temperature potentially then drives the CO2 level. So the question, of course, then becomes what drives the temperature?
Which is a fascinating possibility. You know, I'd be willing, and most scientists that are skeptical about man-caused global warming will say that man is probably causing some global warming. We're not saying that there is no effect that man is causing. Man is probably causing some. The question is how much. But recent research by Sevensmark out of Denmark has, I think, opened up a whole other avenue of research that will possibly explain exactly what happens. In fact, there's a very good evidence that this will be the answer as to why we're having global warming or global cooling at different times. There's a phenomenon known as cosmic radiation. You've heard this talked about. It's in sci-fi films and all the rest and so forth. But there is cosmic radiation. The cosmic radiation is caused by exploding supernovae of sun thousands of light years away. And when that cosmic radiation reaches the Earth, the cosmic rays enter the atmosphere and cause an increase level of cloudiness at the lower elevations. These are the low-level clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, low-level clouds do an interesting thing. They have an ability to reflect. If you've ever been in an airplane and you look down on a sunny day on the top of clouds, the clouds are very white, they're very brilliant.
And right.
The reason why is because the clouds are reflecting a lot of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the energy is not being absorbed by the Earth, then the Earth gets cooler. And so cosmic radiation generally is followed, increased cosmic radiation is generally followed by more clouds and a cooler Earth. Now, when the sun becomes more active, and I'm not talking about just the amount of solar output itself directly,
sure.
even though that does have an effect, but what I'm saying is that where there's more solar winds, the solar winds are made up of these highly charged nuclei and so forth, they have a tendency to push back the cosmic radiation right out of the solar heliosphere, right out of our planetary system.
Mm.
And when that happens, less cosmic radiation reaches the Earth's surface, there is less low cloud formation, and as a consequence, more solar radiation actually reaches the Earth's surface, and the Earth begins to warm. And the mathematics of it suggest that it could explain all of the warming that we've seen so far. There is a 100%, almost, well, I shouldn't say that, 96% correlation between cosmic radiation and low cloud formation, and what we've seen is less low clouds over the last 100 years, an increasing amount, and this is probably causing the actual warming that we're experiencing.
Hmm.
Now, more work has to be done by other scientific teams to demonstrate that they come up with the same results, but at the same time, it looks like that is exactly what causes the Earth to warm and cool, is the amount of solar radiation in the solar activity causing the solar winds that then affect the cosmic radiation and the cloud balance on planet Earth.
Hmm. Very interesting. And that is, to one level, at least to me, kind of counterintuitive, so to speak. It's what I would guess that, you know, the more the sun has its, you know, coronal mass ejections, we have the solar flares and the activity in general, that would kind of increase the temperature on the Earth in that level. But what you're saying is that because of that, it's blocking out the cosmic rays that potentially then could, are leading to the you know, the low atmosphere clouds that you're talking about, and you're referring to the Danish research again. And what is interesting here also, I guess, is that right now we're in a low point, so to speak, of the sun, and we're actually it's going to increase from here. We've just entered into cycle 24, I guess, and
that's right.
It could potentially peak at around 2011 to 2013, something like that. So what that could mean is that we possibly could see, you know, changes again then in the temperature up to those years, right?
That's right. Generally speaking, the last several years we've had a very flat period in our temperatures, and there's been no statistical increase in our temperatures since 1998-2000. Well, that's when the last solar event peak, just as it will in about 2010-2011 again. And it makes sense that we're entering a decline period now, and we'll go start going back up. Now, a Russian team is saying that, you know, if the sun follows its typical course of action, probably after this next solar maximum that occurs in 2010 or so, we'll start to see a major cooling trend again, just like happened in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see a dip in temperatures for 30 to 40 years before it starts to go back up again.
Sheesh. What did you say, 30 or 40 years?
Yeah, it was 1945 to 1975 or so that the Earth actually cooled for a period of time, and that's when the headlines were saying we're entering the next ice age.
Ah, okay, but this then doesn't necessarily follow what do NASA call it, the 11-year cycle where we're up and down period.
Well, we need to recognize that there are cycles upon cycles upon cycles,
sure.
Depending on the planetary closeness to the sun, the solar orbit, and all the rest. And apparently there's the 11-year cycle, and then you have a 40-year cycle, then a 120-year cycle, a 1,500-year cycle, and so forth, depending upon all these interacting forces.
Sure.
And if the Russians are right, I'm not saying they're right, but if they're right, then we could have either a flattening period where there's really no warming at all from about 2010 on, or we'll have a slight cooling like we did in the 1940s through the 1970s.
Very interesting, and I mean, we have many people have heard it, I guess, that they are listening to this program, but it's worth mentioning again, because it's an interesting correlation, that global warming, so to speak, or warming of the planets has been going on throughout our solar system. Isn't that right?
Yes. That is fascinating that you mentioned that. I meant to bring that up a moment ago, in the fact that the various planets and moons of our planets in the solar system are also warming up. And if there is if the other planets are warming up and Earth is warming up, again, it gives credence to the fact that man is probably not causing at least most of the warming. It's a natural phenomenon.
Interesting. And then, of course, you mentioned, you know, the clouds and so forth. And I think you threw out a number in your film regarding the water vapor, that this is one of the main greenhouse gases. And we don't kind of think of that in a way, you know, when we hear all the chatter about the greenhouse gases, everyone thinks of CO2 immediately. But water vapor is even a larger extent a greenhouse gas than CO2.
It's a much more potent greenhouse gas. In fact, if you actually look at the actual potential of as a greenhouse gas, the different greenhouse gases have actually different potentials. In other words, methane is 20 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even though there is much less methane and so forth, it has a much bigger footprint because of the fact that it has a more potent influence on greenhouse gases. But the most potent greenhouse gas is water vapor. And water vapor is one of the things that has been totally ignored. You'll never hear about that in the popular press. And yet water vapor potentially accounts for up to 76% of all the greenhouse gas impacts. And water vapor is going to be there one way or the other. Yes, it on clear, dry days, there's not as much water vapor as there is on a rainy day or a foggy day or something of that nature. But overall, over the whole entire planet, you're going to have about the same amount of water vapor. About 76% of the so-called greenhouse gases are going to be accounted for by water vapor. And at best, at the maximum, carbon dioxide is 27%.
Mm-hmm.
So most of our greenhouse gases is water vapor. We don't have any control over that. Carbon dioxide is 27%, and only 3% of that 27% is actually man-caused. And as a consequence, now you're down to about 0.5% that man is influencing the greenhouse gas composition of planet Earth.
And with water vapor, of course, I guess we could even tie in the rain in that, right?
Yes. In fact, you know, there's a lot of speculation on this, and I can't be any more accurate than anyone else is. Though man-caused proponents basically will say that drier places will become drier, wetter places will become wetter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced of that at all, and there's a lot of scientists that aren't. In fact, there is much evidence to suggest as we become warmer, we're going to have more rainfall, and you can actually begin to see that because apparently during the cooling period from 1940s to the middle of the 1970s, almost in the 1980s, the Sahara Desert advanced south. Well, now that it's warming, the green zone is starting to advance north again, or the Sierra Desert is shrinking again. So there's all kinds of speculation as to exactly what's going to happen with increased global warming. But there is going to have an effect. There's no question that warming is going to have some effects, that it's going to be negative in some places. And rather than spend billions and trillions of dollars, U.S. dollars, in trying to bring down carbon dioxide levels and harming economies, it makes a lot more sense, if you can't really fight it, if it's a natural phenomenon anyway, to try to develop and use that money to adapt to this changing climate rather than try to fight the changing climate.
Right. I see what you mean. You know, I can just say from what I've experiencing this year, at least in Sweden, I guess the consensus of Sweden is that it's very cold and it's a lot of snow, especially during the winter time, of course. But let me tell you, we have had, you know, close to no snow so far yet, and it has been raining incredibly much this year. So I don't know if that's just a seasonal or just a this year, if that's something special. But more generally, we have gotten a little bit, you know, less snow all the time and more rain, it seems like, you know?
Yeah, which I think is going to be quite beneficial to both mankind and nature. Yes, there are certain plants that need to go through a cold period to what we call harden off and to set their chemistry, as it were, so that they can then bud out and flower and so forth in the spring. But we're always going to have enough cold. That's not going to be a major issue. A lot of people are concerned that the we're going to see a radical change to the point where plants are not going to be able to adapt to the warmer temperatures. I don't think that's going to be the case. As an ecosystem ecologist, we have plants that are always in a state of flux in their ranges and so forth, both north and south.
Sure.
And we have historically, for instance, the polar bears, that's another classic example. Many concerns about the polar bears becoming extinct because of the lack of ice. Well, first of all, the lack of ice in the North Sea, or in the North Pole area, Arctic area, is not necessarily caused by the warming, but by changes in ocean currents, and as well as a change in wind pattern for the last couple of years, and it seems to be reversing itself now. That aside, having said that, there's been six times in the last 10,000 years, where it's been as much as 2 degrees warmer than it is right now on planet Earth, as much as 2 degrees, sometimes 3 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those times, we had very sharp temperature changes over a 100-year period, so you're even more sharply than we're seeing today. And the polar bears did fine then, the plants did fine. Yes, they gradually moved north as it became warmer, as it became cooler, they started to move south over a period of time. But the fact is that it's very unlikely that we're going to see any major extinction phenomena because of the increased warming.
Fascinating. And, you know, one thing that Gore talks about is if we were to look at Greenland, that the ice layer there, and he says that a lot of ice is, you know, falling off, so to speak, at the edges. But you brought out a very interesting piece of information in your film here that is about the two, let's see here, how many planes was it? I guess 8 or something in total. Tell us about those planes that went down on Greenland.
Well, it's a fascinating story. When during World War II, the United States were sending planes over to England, and they sent a squadron of P-38s as well as two B-17 bombers. They landed in Greenland, refueled, and were going to Iceland where they were going to refuel and then finally go to England. Well, when they got to Iceland, it was fogged in and they couldn't land, so they had to turn around and try to go back to Greenland. But when they went back to Greenland, it too was fogged in, and they could not land there either. So they ran out of fuel, or were going to run out of fuel, and they finally decided they were going to land on the ice field, not too far from the edge of the southwest corner of Greenland. And they landed. The pilots all survived. And they were picked up about a week later, and everybody survived. It was fine. A team went out in 1982 and tried to find those planes. They figured they would be 10 to 15 feet below the ice surface and so forth.
Mm.
What they found is that those planes were 262 feet below the ice surface. That much ice had accumulated on those planes since 1942 in that 50-year period. And what we're seeing today is that most of the interior ice of Greenland is increasing, still increasing. There are some that is decreasing, but most of the ice is still increasing.
Hmm.
It's along the edges of Greenland where you're seeing the major melting occur.
Sure.
But remember back in the medieval optimum that we talked about earlier in the show, it was much warmer than it is right now. That's when the Vikings actually colonized Greenland. And Greenland then actually was supporting crop growing and so forth. Those along the edges of Greenland is where the ice is melting now, which is exactly what you would expect to see if we're actually warming according and recovering from the little ice age. It's not happening in the middle of the Greenland ice sheet. It's happening along the edges where the Vikings at one time had colonized Greenland.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And you know, one thing here also is to point out, I guess, is that much of the science that we do get at this point actually is from, computer models. They're running, tests after tests, so to speak, on what will happen. They're trying to predict how bad it will get if this continues and so forth. But still, I mean, this is computer models, and they can't add up, so to speak, to the reality of how the climate actually works, right?
No, it can't, and this is a tragic thing. These scientists that are trying to do this modeling are basically good scientists, and that's true of many of them. The problem is that the climate process of Earth is so utterly complex that there's no way that even supercomputers can even begin to approach handling all of the variables involved in climate activity. In fact, one of the modelers actually said this past year that at best they can account for only one half of the variables that go into climate modeling. The rest of them they do not know. And as a consequence, you have 50% of all the variables that can control climate that are not known. Those are all thrown into a black box. What do I mean by that? It means is that this is the way the climate has happened in the past, and we have modeled that, and that way that's what should happen in the future. But it's a black box. They don't know if it's accurate or not accurate. And sure. As a consequence, when they try to actually predict what happened with a starting point back, say, 100 years ago, mm-hmm. those models ultimately fail unless they're tweaked to include all the changes and so forth of that last 100 years. Hmm. And you cannot hope to project another 100 years to see what was going to happen. But there is a major flaw in the models that was uncovered in 2007 that I think the listening audience ought to be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
In every single case, the models assume that the greatest warming is going to occur in the mid-troposphere, up to about 10,000, 12,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the carbon dioxide is, and that's where the warming should be occurring. The problem is that it does not. And as a consequence, the models are making the wrong assumption that the warming is occurring there, and therefore, since they're making the wrong assumptions in that regard, there's no way they can really predict what's going to happen with increasing carbon dioxide. There is another phenomenon. That is that if you look at carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, its ability to, as a greenhouse gas diminishes with higher concentrations. So what that means is that the first shot of carbon dioxide is very, very significant as fact in this respect to greenhouse gas behavior.
Mm.
But the next shot of greenhouse gases becomes less effective and so on and so forth. So as you get up to 300 to 400 parts per million, its efficacy as a greenhouse gas diminishes very sharply to the point where it's almost trivial. Now, the computer models know this. The modelers know this, and they've built it right into the computer models.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the greenhouse gases themselves that's causing the warming at that point. It's what the greenhouse gases they project are going to do. And one of the things that they project they were going to do is to increase more cirrus cloud formations. Those are the high elevation clouds. They're the very thin ones that usually precede a storm. If you see a very high, thin, cloudy layer, you know that you're liable to have a stormy pattern within the next 48 hours or so.
Okay.
And those high, thin cirrus clouds, what they do is they allow quite a bit of solar radiation to hit the Earth's surface and cause the warming. And then when the Earth re-radiates its temperature, the heat back out of the atmosphere in infrared wavelengths, that same cirrus cloud formation traps it. It becomes very efficient. You remember we talked about water vapor being a very effective greenhouse gas. Well, one of the most effective ones is these cirrus clouds formations where you have these little ice particles. And that's what all the models are based upon, is that with increasing carbon dioxide, you get more cirrus cloud formation and therefore much more heat trapped in the Earth's atmosphere. That's what's causing this 2 to 4 degree Celsius increase in temperature projections that the IPCC has been making over the last 15 years. Well, a study was done 2 years ago that showed that this may not be happening. Another study was done and released just this fall, which verified that study of 2 years ago, which was done by Roy Spencer, who was an atmospheric physicist that runs the effort, or has been. He's changed jobs, but he used to work on the satellite station and so forth, satellite data information. He did a study, and along with several others, that basically show that the cirrus cloud formation is not occurring. It's not occurring. Not only is the Earth not warming up at the mid-troposphere levels, but this cirrus cloud formation is not forming, and those are the two basic things that these models use to project the increased warming into the future. And they say that as much, if they're true, if further research proves them out, that the cirrus cloud formation is not occurring, that the Earth is not, the atmosphere is not warming in the mid-troposphere as faster than the surface is, if those two things are borne out when every evidence suggests that they're exactly right, then the amount of warming that we should be expecting should be reduced by at least 75%.
Oops, that's a lot.
Huge amount.
That's a huge amount, you're right. Huh, so it could be thrown off, basically, then, the entire thing, so to speak.
Again, it's not that these computer modelers and so forth, they're trying to do their very best, but the very best is very, very, it is so far off the mark that it should not be used for anything other than trends and kind of wondering what's going on in the future.
Well,
it certainly shouldn't be used for developing international policy.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, one thing also in regards to predicting and you know, working with different variables in regards to computer models and so forth, we have the stuff about the volcanoes, of course. I mean, there is certain scientific evidence that seems to suggest that even the sun could potentially affect, you know, volcanic eruption, things like this. This means that if we were to have a period of a lot of volcanic activity or not so much volcanic activity, this again could totally throw the equations, you know, to the left and to the right, so to speak.
Absolutely. The natural processes of Earth, volcanic activity, even when you have major earthquakes that put tremendous amount of dust into the atmosphere, all those have an effect on climate for a number of years.
Yeah.
When Mount Pinatubo blew its stack, and I think it was 1992 or back in the early 1990s, whenever, we had a very cool couple of years following that because of the amount of particulate matter in the atmosphere that was blocking the sun.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the potential positive effects on CO2. You mentioned it a little bit before, but I mean, could it be that we're could enter into something completely new, meaning that you know, certain areas that today are very dry or, you know, don't have you know, soil to grow food and so forth, that this could actually be better or increase in regards to what I just, you know, mentioned there?
It very definitely can. And I just want to mention that if you want to see a 5-minute trailer of the video that we're talking about, you can find it on warmingdvd.com. That's warmingdvd.com or globalwarminggloballgovernance.com, either one. You can actually see a 5-minute trailer about what we're talking about. And one of the things that I do talk about in that 5-minute trailer is the effect of carbon dioxide. I think it's probably true in Europe as well as the United States that most high school or upper grade level in our educational process goes into the importance of carbon dioxide as a food for plants. In other words, carbon dioxide is the main food for plants. It absorbs, plants absorb carbon dioxide. They turn it into food material for themselves. And then when they burn it off and so forth, they emit in the process, I should say, oxygen that we need. So it's a cycle. We give off carbon dioxide, plants use carbon dioxide and give off oxygen that we then use. Well, it turns out that if you go back in history, that carbon dioxide levels millions of years ago were at least 10 times what they are right now in our atmosphere. Much, much higher than what we see today in our atmosphere. And as a consequence, as plants evolved or were created, depending on your viewpoint, those plants were created at or evolved in a time when you had much higher levels of carbon dioxide, which means that carbon dioxide today is limiting to those plants. And as every increase in carbon dioxide that you have an increase in plant productivity. In fact, there has been a lot of research, thousands and thousands of research projects done around the world over the last 15 or 20 years that show a doubling of carbon dioxide levels will increase the world's food production by as much as 25 to 50%. A huge increase in food production. The plants themselves are healthier. They can stand more drought. They can stand more other pollutant effects and so forth. It's a boon. It's almost like a free fertilizer to the third world nations of the world that cannot produce enough food for themselves. It gives them an automatic boost in their food production, and they don't have to pay a dime for it. It is almost, and I literally call it a miracle gas. It is one of the most important gases that we have in our atmosphere right now for the survival of mankind, the benefit of mankind, as well as the environment. Because what happens when you have enriched carbon dioxide levels in their environment is that ecosystems are also healthier, much more robust, which then provides more habitat and food for animals, and the animals in our forests and so forth are much better off. And so carbon dioxide really does have some serious advantages. In fact, NASA has actually measured, taken photographs from space, the greening of planet Earth because of the increased levels of carbon dioxide as well as increased temperatures. Mm-hmm. Both of them combined make a dynamic duo, as it were, that really benefit mankind as well as the plant and animal kingdoms of the world.
Hmm. And that kind of opens up a little bit of can of worms if we were to tie in that this actually might be a plan. But let's hold off on a little bit more on that and discuss that in our next segment. We have about 3-4 minutes left here before we should take a break. But, you know, I want to ask you a little bit about the documentary, The Great Global Warming Swindle. It has gotten a lot of criticism. What do you think about that documentary?
Well, I saw there was a couple of errors involved in it, at least I think they're errors, but overall it is a fantastic video if you have that. I know it's being sold in Europe right now. If you can get your hands on that, that would be a excellent video. I really do promote that video very, very strongly. The errors that I think might exist in it are rather trivial compared to what it really does portray as far as its refutation of the man-caused global warming theory.
Hmm, interesting. And, of course, your own film, Global Warming or Global Governance. When did you produce that film, by the way?
That came out in midsummer of this past year, and we're going to be doing, I think, in the next 6 months or so, a revision of that, improving it and expanding it. But it really does show very clearly what I think is happening, not only from the science standpoint and why man-caused global warming is probably not correct, but also goes into the whys. Why have $50 billion in the United States been spent on promoting this idea that man is causing global warming? Hmm. Why are we spending that kind of money? Why are we trying to do the things around the world, this Kyoto Protocol, when there doesn't seem to be a major problem in that? And that's the other thing that the DVD goes into, is explaining why we're trying to create the whole process of what's known as global governance.
Right. And, you know, just to ask you a little bit about your participation in Endgame, Alex Jones' latest film, has that kind of helped a little bit, I guess, to get the message out, so to speak?
I think so. You know, I spent a lot of time with Alex Jones in the production of that, several days of interviews and so forth. He didn't use a lot of it that I did interview. I guess he's coming out with another DVD with my interview on it. But nonetheless, the Endgame, if you look at the dynamics of what he talks about, especially the history of the effort to come to global governance, he nails it right on. And I would strongly advise getting that particular video as well.
Excellent. You know, I think this would be a good time here to take a little break here, and then, you know, Michael and I are going to continue talking in our subscriber section and go into a little bit more about the global governance aspect of all of this. Does this connect with the United Nations, the IPCC, and so forth? What is the plan for humanity? So much more is coming up. But before we do that, I want to kind of leave the floor open to you here, Michael, so you can mention the websites that you have out there, of course, and also how people can get a hold of your film.
You can get the Global Warming, Global Governance DVD by going to www.globalwarminggloballgovernance.com or warmingdvd.com. That's warmingdvd.com. Either website, either address takes you to the same website, and you can see a 5-minute trailer, and you can actually order the DVD on that website to get it in anywhere in Europe as well. In fact, most of our orders are actually coming from Australia and New Zealand at this time. I shouldn't say most, but a lot of them are. So this is having an impact worldwide.
Well, exactly. That's right. I mean, as they are trying to, you know, project this as a global problem that actually needs you need to kind of reach a global audience then too, I guess.
Yes, that's correct. Our other website is discerningtoday.org, which goes into more of the global governance side of what is actually happening, and sovereignty international.net or sovereignty.net is another website that we have that actually is sponsoring the Global Warming DVD. That is a 501c tax exempt organization that has attended many United Nations meetings and so forth in their efforts to try to advance this concept called global governance.
There we go. Okay, excellent. You know, we're going to take a little break here then, but for this segment here, thank you so much, Michael, for coming on, but we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Okay.